Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you for our Tuesday podcast. On my mind, breaking the silence that surrounds domestic violence. Abuse in the home accounts for 15% of all violent crime in the U.S., but it's rarely discussed in public. So damaging myths linger, like, if it was bad enough, the victim would just leave. An abuser can never change. And the things that happen behind closed doors are private matters. Journalist Rachel Louise Snyder talked to victims, abusers, and law enforcement to paint a picture of the roots, scope, and consequences of domestic abuse in America. Her new book is titled No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Rachel, it's so good to see you.
It's great to be here, Diane.
The shocking statistics that you have brought in your book: domestic violence accounts for 15% of all violent crime in the U.S.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? And just last month, in the middle of April 2019, as we sit here, the number of domestic violence homicides for the first time in decades has been on the rise since 2017. So, you know, for years, we have said 3 women a day in the U.S. are killed. We've used that stat for years. And that's a shocking statistic when you think about it. And that number is now 4.
So there's always a behind-the-scenes story as to why you chose to write this book. Tell me why.
You know, I was a foreign correspondent for years. I covered stories around the world. I've traveled to 50-something countries. And I'd always done, you know, stories of human rights and women's issues and humanitarian social issues. And domestic violence was parallel or a part of every single one of those stories, so much so that I'm embarrassed to say, I don't think I ever even asked about domestic violence. I just assumed it was there. Of course, a child bride in Romania or India is also going to be a domestic violence victim most of the time. So that was one thing. The other thing was I was standing on the driveway of a dear friend of mine, and his sister drove up. They were all going on an extended family vacation. And he introduced me, and I said, oh, Suzanne DeBuse, it's very nice to meet you. I've heard your name before, you know, and I did that American thing. So what do you do? And she said, I work in domestic violence advocacy. And I was like, oh, that seems interesting. And I said, okay, what more specifically? And she said, we try to predict domestic violence homicides before they happen using risk indicators. I remember, like, my body getting energized, like, wait a minute, how can you do that? And I followed her around as she, you know, her brother Andre sent her on all these tasks to the farmer's market and to the liquor store. And I just followed her around, you know, taking notes and asking her more and more. And so many things were stunning to me really all at once in that moment. One, that you could predict a social ill like this. Two, that we could address it in some way. You know, other things, poverty, homelessness, mental health, there's avenues to that seem obvious even to the layperson to address those things. And domestic violence was not that to me. I really thought of it as private.
So tell me some of the indicators, not only that she pointed out, but that you found out in researching this book.
Right. That's a good question, because there are indicators that are sort of official in the way that they use a program to predict. And those indicators are things like, obviously, prior incidents of domestic violence, but also gun ownership is one. Unemployment or erratic employment can be another one. Beatings while pregnant, another one. Control and isolation, controlling all or most of someone's daily activities. Isolating someone from their friends and family. These are all risk indicators, threats of suicide, threats of homicide. But some other ones that are just sort of red flags to me are things like very short courtships, right? Someone is claiming love within, I don't know, 2 weeks, a week, 2 weeks of knowing, which happens with young people all the time, right? When you're 15, you supposedly fall in and out of love all the time. So, short courtships is one of them, that level of intensity. There's a number, and I think young people are particularly susceptible.
Talk about Michelle and Rocky.
So Michelle and Rocky were a very young couple in Montana. They met when Michelle was 14 and Rocky was 24. He looked very young for his age and she looked older. And again, sort of seemed to fall in love instantly. And she was pregnant by the time she was 15, had their first child. Now, she came from, you know, a middle-class family that was educated. Her parents were divorced, but they were both in her life. A lot of extended family around.
Did they try to intervene?
Absolutely, they tried to intervene. Her mother, Sally, met Rocky and said, I don't know how old he is, but he has a car, so he's too old for you. And so Michelle saw him secretly. But then once she was pregnant, she was stuck. And Michelle's parents, both of them, really struggled with whether or not to try and charge him with statutory rape. And even his parents said to him, if you get charged with that, we'll support you, but we are not going to get you out of this. You got yourself into this mess. And Michelle just said to everyone, if you charge him, we're going to run away together and you'll never see me. And Sally decided that it was better to have her daughter and her grandchild nearby, where at least she could be in their lives.
They were nearby.
And so she had another child the next year, but she still graduated from high school on time at 18. And they tried to make a life. But of course, Rocky was very controlling, didn't let her work.
Did he have a job?
He had a job that was sporadic. Initially, he had a job when he first met that took him away for months at a time as a seismologist. And so he quit that. And after he quit that, he sort of had seasonal construction work and things like that. So not a lot of work. She offered to get a part-time job, and he lost his mind, took her grandfather's gun, and threatened to kill her and kill the kids.
If she got a job.
And she actually called his parents to come over, and they intervened in that instance. But nobody thought that he was dangerous in that way.
Was he beating her? Were there signs of abuse?
Her sister and one other person saw signs of physical abuse, but no one else. And in fact, Michelle and Rocky and their two kids spent a lot of time with his family because he had isolated her from her family. And his parents say, we didn't see bruises on her. And this is the thing that you have to understand about domestic violence, is that so much of it doesn't actually need to be physical. I'll give you one chilling example. Rocky went up to an area outside of Billings called the Rims and got a rattlesnake, a diamondback western rattlesnake, brought it home, put it in a cage, and told Michelle that he would put it in the shower with her or put it in bed with her if she did anything that upset him. So she's living with a snake. And she said, okay, what am I going to do here? Where am I going to go? I can't leave and go somewhere else. He'll find me. He'll track me down.
So she kept it from her own family?
She kept it from her own family until at one point she started to believe that he was having an affair. Her mother doesn't believe that she ever thinks he was having an affair. She thinks that was just a sort of excuse that could be acceptable to the outside world as to why Michelle was trying to leave or going to leave. But at any rate, she was going to confront him. So she took her kids to her mother's house and said, don't let him take them. Now, no one knew that every time for years that she did something that upset him, he would take the kids and go camping for the night or take them to a motel for the night, and she wouldn't know where they were. You know, we have a term for women in her situation in the domestic violence community. There's a term called passive hostages, and that's really what they are.
What were the laws in place at the time? Could she have gone to the police?
Well, she did eventually go to the police. So when she dropped the kids off at her mother's house, he went, and about an hour later, Sally saw his car pull up, and he broke into the house, broke a window, got blood everywhere, went in, hit Michelle's sister, Melanie, who was there at the time and 6 months pregnant, left her covered in bruises. Sally tried to cover the kids up with her own body. And the granddaughter, the oldest girl, Christy, said, "No, no, it's okay, Bugga." They called her grandmother Bugga. "It's okay, Bugga, I'll go." So they had seen their father like this. And so Sally called the police. Michelle actually never ended up calling the police, but Sally called the police. And Michelle spent that night at her mother's house with her son. And that was the first time in almost 10 years that Sally had heard these stories of abuse. And Michelle did file an affidavit and filed for a restraining order and thought that that would be maybe something that would work to calm him down.
But
he called his parents and he manipulated them as so many abusers do, made promises to be better, said he had a right to his children, and they bailed him out. And at the time, there was no mechanism to notify Michelle. A lot of states now have a requirement to notify a victim before an abuser gets out. But by the time Michelle found out that he was getting bailed out. He was already at his brother's house. And so she freaked out. She went back to the prosecutor's office. She recanted everything. She said she'd made it all up.
Ah.
And they threw out the charges.
They threw out the charges. And she did so because?
Because she knew that she had to put up a front to side with him, or the retaliation would be so much greater. Because now she has an abuser who's angry. He has other people involved. He has a system involved, and he has to show her that he's more powerful than the system. So 70%, some stats say 80% of victims recant, and that's why.
He finally takes the ultimate action against Michelle, his own children, and himself.
Yeah. He went through the Thrifty Nickel classifieds and bought a gun. Guns are in Montana. Guns are everywhere. I mean, guns are everywhere in this country. And he killed Michelle first. And it's clear that he did it in front of the kids. And she was shot 4 times. And then he shot his daughter and then his son. They both fell on the basement stairs. And then he shot himself. He actually, before he shot himself, he took 14 hours of family videos that they had been collecting over the years, put them in a bag in the garage, which was separate from the house, and left a note saying, "I love Michelle with all my heart till death do us part." And then he tried to set the house on fire so that it would look like an accident. But it was winter time, and he didn't open any windows, so there was no oxygen feeding the fire. So it just smoldered and burned very hot, but did never alight. And then he shot himself, and he died of asphyxiation. So he was somewhat unsuccessful in his, you know.
Oh, Rachel, yeah. What a horrible, horrible story. Mm-hmm. What year was this occurrence?
2001.
It must have been so difficult for you to learn the facts of that story.
You know, I've come across a lot of, not just domestic violence homicide, but, you know, I've reported on a lot of horrible stories. But there's a way in which when you're doing a book, you're spending years with people. I mean, I saw a picture, for example, of Michelle. They had a special casket built for her and her two kids that would hold all three of them. And her sister showed me that picture. And I went back to my hotel that night in Billings, and it was rough. I mean, I took a year off at one point from researching this. So, it's not hard. I mean, I could point to scenes in this book and say, this one was hard to write. This one I cried through writing it.
The casket you mentioned held Michelle and her two children with her arms wrapped around them.
That's right. That's right. And, I mean, as an image, it's seared into me, as is that rattlesnake. And her, you know, her family is so incredible. I spent so many years going back and forth interviewing them, and it was so hard. I mean, I think, you know, her mother cried, of course, every single time. But also, I have to say, Rocky's parents also talked to me. And that, to me, there is a level of courage in that. His father had never spoken aloud to anybody about those murders.
Did his parents have any indication that that's something that was within him?
Well, there is an element of hindsight. You know, it's hard for them to disentangle what they thought back then versus what they know now. So things that are signs to them now were not necessarily signs at the time, but he was a troubled youth. He was angry. He engaged in sort of petty thievery. He had drug problems. He spent a year in a boys' home for troubled youth. You know, he dropped out of high school. He spent some time in prison in Texas on a drug charge. I think about a year or so. So he had, you know, all those things are sort of signs. His stepmother says he was extremely manipulative. And so that's, you know, you could look at that as a sign, but there are lots of people who, I mean, I myself had a troubled youth, you know, I didn't graduate from high school either. I did go on to grad school. But you know, there are many people who have that, in their youth, and they grow out of it or they learn or whatever. So it's hard to say.
So the failures in her case, what would you put at the top?
I would say that there was a failure for any one entity to try to get the whole story. So when Sally called the police, for example, they showed up and said, "What do you want us to charge him with?" That is outrageous. I don't think that would ever happen in Montana today, but it happened then. So that was one thing. The prosecuting attorney did not make any attempt to sort of see evidence beyond what Michelle said or what Michelle recanted. So she knew, for example, I mean, the snake was such a specific detail that she knew Michelle was lying when she said she'd made it up. She knew there really was a snake. But nobody, it seems like nobody went to the house to actually investigate, to find that physical evidence, right? They didn't interview others. They didn't do a kind of risk assessment of some of these other risk indicators. Has he ever threatened to kill you or the children? Has he, you know, beaten you while pregnant? I mean, any of those, nobody knows. So to me, and this is true of sort of all domestic violence and domestic violence homicides, it's not one big aha thing. It's a series of such tiny adjustments that we need to make.
So have some of those been made since her death?
Yeah, her death was, it made national headlines out in the West. It shocked the whole state. There are people still today who are sort of haunted by her death. There's a program we have across most states in the country called Fatality Review, Fatality Review Teams, and they look specifically at domestic violence homicides, investigate them, and try to determine what policy or systemic changes could be made. And so in Montana, Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team formed, and hers was the first case they took on. And so they made recommendations. And some of the recommendations are really simple things like an abuser will never be bailed out before a victim is alerted with enough time to make a safety plan. Something really simple like that. There's also a movement across the country that's been going. And in fact, it was going at the time that Michelle was killed but had not was not really widely in use in Montana, called evidence-based prosecution, which uses all other evidence to try to prosecute a domestic violence case rather than having a victim come and take the stand. And they use things like police reports. Now there's all kinds of, you know, video with police cameras. They use things like witness testimony, you know, neighbors, family members who will take the stand, that kind of thing. Photographs of an abuser raging. They train police to look at a scene differently. Like a police officer might show up and it might be all calm and have a victim say, no, no, we're fine, we shouldn't have called. But if that police officer can look around the house and see maybe there's a pot of spaghetti hanging from the wall or some furniture in disarray, that shows evidence that a prosecutor can use.
More from Rachel Louise Snyder when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Rachel Louise Snyder. Her new book is titled No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. As you and I both know, this has been going on for so long, and for so many years, police were told you don't intervene in domestic violence.
That's right.
Cases.
That's right. Well, it was our law. You know, men had a right to beat their wives. I mean, we used to call it wife beating. You know, I think partly it's that there are jurisdictions where you still have that attitude. I mean, I was in Montana reporting and I had a state senator, Margie McDonald, say to me that she had been in a congressional hearing and heard a fellow lawmaker say that. Well, that's just that, you know, that's their private business.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that attitude is pervasive still today. But I do think that we're changing. I honestly don't think this conversation between you and I, well, okay, maybe you, because you're a unique brand, but I don't think this conversation would have happened 10 years ago when I started researching domestic violence. Nobody cared. Nobody was paying attention at all.
I have to tell you, when I first started out doing the Diane Rehm show back in 1979, there was a huge scandal here in Washington because, as I recall, the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission was found guilty of abusing his wife, and he had done so in total secret. Here is a man at the top of the government, and he's doing this. Things have not changed enough.
I'd like to say that that story surprises me, but it does not. It goes unseen still today among, at least among that population of men who can afford to pay their way out of any kind of accountability.
No, we did do a number of programs on domestic violence because it is so pervasive and the laws were somehow so much in favor of the abuser rather than the abused.
Sure. I mean, you see that still today. You know, it wasn't a specific law. There was no specific law against domestic violence, even here in the District of Columbia where I live in Washington, D.C., until 1991. So, you know, we are slow to catch up with social movements in terms of our policy and in terms of our body of jurisprudence. More than half the women in prison for homicide are in prison for retaliatory violence against their abusers. I had a researcher tell me, and I think she maybe has, you've interviewed her before, Jacqueline Campbell at Johns Hopkins University. She's the country's foremost researcher in domestic violence. And I was sitting in on a seminar that she was doing in outside of Detroit one time. And she said, the states where homicides of men have been reduced are the states where we know domestic violence policies are more progressive. The states where homicides of men are reduced. And I thought, oh, she means women. I'm going to tell her that afterwards, you know? And I was like, And someone in the audience asked, like, did you mean women? I was like, yeah. She meant women, all right? No, she meant men. Because those are states where victims have more resources and don't have to shoot their way out of an abusive situation. Isn't that shocking?
Shocking. So your own daughter is a little girl. But what would you say to her as she grows up about how to recognize the potential for that kind of abuse? It may begin as a wonderful, loving relationship, but what are the signs that women should look out for?
That's a great question. And I think one thing I would say is, you know, I often hear women say, well, I'd leave the minute he punched me. Well, that doesn't really give you an indication of what it would be like on the inside. First of all, he may never punch you. He may instead throw something against the wall, a plate that just, you know, shatters you and cuts your eye, which, by the way, according to the Supreme Court, is domestic violence. He may slam a door on you or let a door slam on you, right? There are things like that. But I would even go further than that. I would say to my daughter, be suspicious of love at first sight. I would say be suspicious of someone who's jealous of your friendships with not just other boys, but other girls, or your family relationships, or your responsibilities that you have. If someone says, you know, your schoolwork is more important to you than I am, that to me is suspicious. I'm not saying, you know, that person is going to grow up to be an abuser, but I'm saying just have your antenna up. I would say anyone who begins to isolate a partner or, you know, a young partner, I would say anyone who tries to control how they dress or how much makeup they wear or their interactions with people, anybody who says things like, you know, you really embarrassed me when we were out with our friends the other night because you said X, Y, and Z about me. That's an indication of, you know, narcissism potentially. And these things individually, a lot of them might be harmless, but it's the collection of them at once.
What happened to shelters that women who are abused used to go to?
Well, the first problem is that there just are not enough. There are not enough beds. You know, here in the District of Columbia, we have under 2,000 shelter beds for 30,000 domestic violence calls a year, more or less. Now, not all those calls need to be in shelter, but that just gives you a frame of reference. So the first thing is that there just simply aren't enough. But the bigger problem is that there are many cases where shelter is the right answer. They are so volatile in any given moment that someone needs to be taken out of that situation for their own safety. That happens. But shelters are, in a sense, a way for the criminal justice system to get off the hook, right? To say, oh, well, she's gone to shelter, so the problem is solved. When in fact, shelter is extremely disruptive. Most shelters are chronically underfunded. And there's a time limit on how long you can stay. You can only bring X amount of suitcases. You're all in one room. So you may be in a room with your two kids or your three kids. You can't bring your family pet or your heirlooms. A lot of shelters have very strict security protocols for obvious reasons. So you cannot tell friends and family where you are. In many cases, you can't even contact friends and family. You can't hold a regular job. Right? If you have a job and you go to shelter, your ex can just follow you from your job right to that shelter and he'll know or she'll know, right? So shelters often don't take boys. There's an all-male shelter that opened up in, I think it's Arkansas a few years ago. It was the country's first. But, you know, they're extremely disruptive. You've got a child who's in soccer, for example, and suddenly that child can't play soccer. You've got a child who is doing testing in school, and suddenly the child's not there for testing. And you're housing a traumatized family with a whole slew of other traumatized families. I mean, it's sort of amazing that we thought this was a good solution.
Yeah. Rachel, I know you talked not only to women and men who were abused, but you also talked to abusers themselves.
You know, that was so important to me to include them. From the moment I conceived of this book, I thought, I cannot tell this story only from the side of the victim. Because if we do not allow everybody involved to talk, then we're missing part of the story. And we're also missing the opportunity to figure out what we can do to stop violence at its origins. So I was really nervous. The first batterers intervention group that I sat in on was outside of Boston in Cambridge. And I sort of sat in the corner and seven men walked into the room.
This was a group therapy situation.
It was group. They were all court ordered to be there. So they all had, domestic violence charges. And it was mind blowing because any one of those seven guys I'd have gone for a beer with. They were charming. They were funny. They ran the age, race, and economic gamut. I mean, I couldn't believe it. They were joking around with each other when they first walked in. And it was just stunning to me. And that's when it really hit home that, like, it's not just that any of us could be a victim. Any of us could also be an abuser.
How did they describe themselves as abusers?
They don't describe themselves as abusers. Absolutely nobody describes themselves as an abuser. They really compartmentalize it. In fact, many of them, the majority of them, had had abuse in their homes as children. And the night I went to that particular group, they were talking about their fathers. And it was so interesting because I think five of the seven or six of the seven acknowledged that their fathers had abused their mothers, but blamed their mothers for inciting that abuse, which, by the way, is what all the domestic violence research said until about the 70s in this country. So this is sort of, in some ways, new territory.
So how do you cure that? Therapy group when guys are sitting around joking, laughing, and saying, well, she incited me. She did this. She did that.
Well, I think there's a difference between therapy and batterer's intervention, or a difference between anger management and batterer's intervention. You know, anger management is sort of behavioral. It's usually a 12-week program. You know, someone who gets road rage or whatever. I mean, anger can be, of course, dangerous. Batterer's intervention, if it's a good program, it certainly has components of behavioral pedagogies in it, but it also addresses systemic gender inequality. It also addresses gender norms in society. So there's one in California, for example, that talks about that teaches men not only that women have been taught to be subservient, but that men have been taught to be to have a certain expectation of authority over women. And what I found in that group, it was fascinating because men, it was like they had this, you know, the clouds parted when they realized that they were a product of socialization and acculturation too. It's fascinating. And I don't know, you know, I stray from words like solve and cure because I'm not under the illusion that, like, we can eradicate violence from our society entirely, but our options are to do nothing and lose our women and children in such vast numbers, or to try, and also to work with men because I think they're happier too when their relationships are satisfying.
Rachel, thank you so much for this book.
It's my pleasure.
That's all for today. I'd love to hear your reactions. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianereem.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Yurvlipker. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you again on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.